Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, everybody, it is mid-November now. I cannot believe how fast just everything has gone. I mean, it's been a crazy quick year. The bee season, God, it was just so fast this year. And, you know, there's a couple things. There's so many things on my mind I want to talk to everybody about. First off, I miss you guys. I miss you very much. I miss talking to you all the time. And it's a combination of things. You know, some of it's my fault and some of it's just the seasonality of beekeeping. But the my fault piece of that is I enjoy engaging with all of you. And if I'm not regularly putting together episodes, then you guys don't engage me as much, which completely makes sense. But I've got a lot of stuff going on that I'm trying to do. It's just this time of year is so busy. I mean, we've got just everything that has to get winterized and put away. And it's just a hectic time, you know, every year. But one thing I wanted to bring up is specifically the Discord room. You know, in the Discord room, of course, everybody's always chatting. It's a very active place. But there's a little bit of a kind of an asterisk, a little caveat there. From about February, March until July, it's crazy active. And then there is this precipitous drop-off. And I've noticed it for years, and I just kind of got used to it. But a few people have messaged me like, hey, man, I thought you said that there was a lot of activity going on in the Discord room. Like, why do I go in there and there's nobody there? So I went back and I actually pulled some metrics, and I looked over the last 4 years. And basically what we have is there is a ramp up that starts in the month of March and it ramps up until about like right around the 20th, 25th of May. And then from May through July, it's a nice gradual taper down. And then by the time we get to like the end of July, my numbers are about, I don't know, like a 50 to 70% reduction in what they usually are. It just drops off. And it happens every year. It's not anything new, but I wanted to kind of look at the metrics, and it's funny to watch because you see it like a chart. It goes up and then it kind of rolls over and comes down about halfway, and then it goes up and it goes higher than it did before. Like every year, like I think we had about a 30 to 50%, you know, gain in listeners last year. And, you know, there's a lot of growth in the channel and with all the other activities we have going on, but it's a weird pattern to see. And especially if you're a person who you're thinking like, oh, wow, this guy talks about this Discord room and there's over 300 members, you know, I should go join and check it out. And then you get there and nobody's talking. So I promise you that if you are, you know, listening to the podcast and you're going onto the Discord room and you want to kind of engage with everybody and start chatting and things, and there's not a lot going on, just hang in there. There's probably like a core group of about 8 to 10 people who are still pretty active right now. Somebody will say something and then you'll have like 40 or 50 messages where everybody's chatting it up. Everybody's kind of like in listen mode. So people are paying attention, but not necessarily engaging. And again, you know, I've got to accept a certain level of responsibility here too, because I can always go on and be like, hey, what do you guys think about this or that? Like I said, I've just been kind of hustling lately, trying to get, just to get a lot of stuff done. It's a long story. And, you know, there's a listener several years ago who had emailed, and I can't remember what I think they were used to be in some kind of a field, maybe in editing or something. And I don't remember the details of it. I apologize if you're listening still, but they kind of had some suggestions, because I'm always open to, you know, people's thoughts, ideas, and suggestions around different things. And they were like, one of the things they said was like, don't tell everybody all the stuff you're going to do, you know, just do it and then tell them that you did it. Otherwise you sound like a politician. And I was like, okay, you know, thanks for the feedback, whatever. And I kind of put it in the back burner and I kept going about my day. But you probably see this a lot where I come on and I'm like, hey, I'm working on this, I'm working on that, I'm trying to get this done, trying to get that done. And sometimes they all happen and sometimes they all get done and sometimes they never get done. And I feel bad. I'm really just trying to be transparent with all of you to say, hey, here's the 20 different things I'm working on right now. And, you know, hopefully 5 or 6 of them will happen this year. I don't know how it works. But anyway, so I want that person, if they're still listening, to know that I did take the feedback seriously. And I do recognize that, because I see this a lot where I'm just trying to tell all of you, like, hey, here's what's going on. And just so, because I mean, like I said, I'm always open to ideas. And somebody might say, hey, I heard you mention the other day you're thinking about doing this. You know, what would be really cool is if we could also see, you know, this and that. So that kind of leads me into a little bit of what I want to talk to you about today, because the plans that I had for today were really to just kind of give you a bunch of updates, tell you what's going on. And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, geez, a lot of this stuff isn't going to happen anytime soon, and you're probably not going to necessarily care. So what I decided to do was just give you a concrete plan of the things that are exactly definitely going on that I'm working right now, and kind of leave it at that. And then I'm going to go through, I'm going to answer just a couple of recent messages, a couple of questions that have come in. And then after I'm done recording this today, I'm going to record another episode, because there is a gentleman in the Discord room named DJ who was harassing me for a while about, so he sent a message, I think it was like August, September, like, hey, I really want to talk about splits. And I was like, hey man, that's a spring discussion. He's like, yeah, I just want to be ready. So I'm going to do this again, and it's going to hopefully be at least the same level, maybe even some more detail, but I'm going to record that today as well. And you know, we'll get that out here in the next week. And that way, everybody who's thinking about splits, which if you think about it, it's probably not even a bad idea to talk about it now when things are quiet and there's not a lot going on, you can start making your split plans in February, March in preparation for April, May. So we're going to record that today as well. But specifically today, I do want to give you a few updates. So as you know, I got the property in North Carolina. That's where the apiary has been historically. There were times where I had bees there. There were times where it was more of a staging area to get them on pollination or to get them somewhere else. I had sold a bunch of them, and then I had brought some back, and then I made a deal with someone else to put them on a piece of land. It was kind of like just south of Orlando, and on some leased land down there. And about a week after they got there, the storm came through, which is a whole separate discussion, so I'm not even going to go into all that. But as a lot of you know, I've got the, you know, there was the sawmill and the bobcat and a lot of the hardware, and I was trying to mill all of my own lumber, and I wanted to, you know, use that lumber to build bee boxes. And I thought, man, this is going to be great. I know this tree guy. He can get me unlimited access to trees. I'll have more, you know, more trees than I know what to do with. So, I mean, I ultimately, you know, I was pretty excited. I had a lot of things down there to start milling, and it just seemed like one thing or another just didn't work out. It's about an hour and a half away from the house, so I'm like stuck like camping in the woods. Cause I think, that's right. For you, those of you who are the longtime listeners. So the RV, I used to stay in the RV when I was down at the property, and, I sold the RV. I'm like, you know, I'm not using it other than, you know, coming down here a couple of days here and there. It's still under warranty. I'm just going to go ahead and sell it. So I sold the RV. So now, if I want to hang out at the property, I'm camping, which is fine. I don't mind doing that. But, you know, if it's middle of the summer, it's pretty doggone humid, and it's right next to the swamp. Now, I know somebody's going to pick on me and bully me about this, but I'm not a huge fan of, like, camping out with the copperheads and the water moccasins and all that. But, you know, that's where it goes back to that cabin that I talked about building several times. And one of the big roadblocks and obstacles I'm up against is I've just got these like back and knee things from like legacy army days. And I think that when I was younger, I could just kind of suck it up and drive on. I could just say, hey, you know what? It hurts, but I'm going to push forward. I'm going to push through. And yeah, I'm kind of at a point now where the suck factor is a little bit higher than I'd like it to be. And it hurts more and it lasts longer. And so I ultimately made the decision. It was a really tough one to make, but I did find it a good home. I sold my sawmill. There was a super cool, really, really nice guy And he's down in South Carolina, and he got a hold of me, and we worked out a deal, and I felt that it was the right fit. And he bought the sawmill. And so once the sawmill was gone, you know, I got that big, heavy Bobcat T870 track loader. So I took the Bobcat, and, you know, I was holding it for a while, and I was like, I don't want to let you go. And because this thing's like a little tank. And finally, I was like, you got to let it go. So I put the Bobcat up for sale, and that found a great home. There's a guy down in North Carolina, runs a cattle farm down there. Really, really nice guy. I was able to get down there. I delivered it for him because I wanted to make sure that, you know, he didn't have to arrange delivery and everything. And I went down there and hung out with him for a couple hours. He put me in a quad, and we, you know, drove around the pasture, and he was pointing out all the different species of cattle that he had, and you know, talking about how they've bred for different features and different things. And it really just a super good fella. So the Bobcat has a good home. And so as these things that were all part of this kind of logging and forestry infrastructure are leaving, you know, next up on the list is the, I got a little choked up for a second there, the Kubota KX 057-5 with the forestry mulcher. I love that piece of equipment. That thing is so amazing. And, you know, I had some great ideas with a lot of this stuff, tying it all in together with, you know, the forestry work and some of these other logging things. And it was just, oh, I was so excited about that. And it's a great piece of equipment. That forestry mulcher is absolutely amazing. But as I looked at trying to, well, one of the big things I mentioned to you guys earlier is the guy that I know who is a, you know, like a logging guy, or not a logging guy, but he's a tree guy, been cutting down trees for 30 plus years or whatever. He was kind of my in for the air quotes, you know, as many trees as you want kind of thing. So this guy had a stroke. Like 2 years ago, he had a stroke. And I was like, well, that's interesting. So the guy I was counting on for my trees is kind of out of commission. And then like 2 weeks later has another one. 3 months later has another one. So he really, really took a beating. So with not having necessarily the good access to trees, I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I've got all this equipment. Let me look into seeing how I can put it to work. What I wanted to do was get a, you know, crew of guys together and put them on various types of work and projects. And there were a lot of logistical challenges around that. I'm not a licensed general contractor. I really don't want to go through the process of doing that, which then means I've got to be a sub to somebody else. And that just wasn't sounding like the most appealing thing. So I thought, you know what? I've got the equipment. Let me rent it out. So I reached out to the company that handles all my insurance for all my equipment and everything. And I said, look, I'm just going to establish a small rental business, put all this hardware into that. You know, what do you think? And the guy was like, oh, it's a great idea. The problem is insurance for, you know, rental businesses and the general liability associated and all of that. He said, it's through the roof. He said, most of the mom and pop organizations throughout the country have been swallowed up by bigger companies like your Sunbelt and some of the other bigger ones because the smaller ones just can't afford the insurance anymore. And I thought, you know, as a startup with no money, you know, there's no, I'm not going to just drop 20 or 30 grand into a startup rental business. So I thought, well, I'm not going to go ahead and start spending tons of money in insurance to start a equipment rental company and try and compete with the big boys. So I was like, you know what? We're just going to let it go. So that's next on the list here. The next thing on the list is getting rid of the Kubota. So if you happen to know anybody, I'll deliver anywhere in the lower 48. I will deliver it to you. You can get the trailer with it. So it's got a 20,000 pound trailer. It's a Pintle pull. But anyway, I'm not going to bore you guys with all of the all of those excavator details and all that kind of stuff. But the real takeaway here is that all of that stuff is going away. And then what I'm going to do is just keep my small little, I got a Bobcat 331 mini excavator. I'm going to keep that just to do grading and things around the property in preparation for what's, you know, coming in the next couple of years. So we'll keep you updated on all of that stuff. Okay, but now that we're back from a quick break here, I want to talk to you about what's actually getting done, what the real plans are that are 100% happening right now, not speculative, maybe, might, could, whatever. We're talking about the real things. So the things that I am working on right now is I'm going to walk all of you through the process of establishing your new apiary. And what I mean by this is, and this, it's a little bit trickier because I can just press the record button. I can start recording. And so doing a podcast is pretty straightforward. Doing video, I need a good indoor recording space for some of the more, you know, things where you want to be more professional. Like, for example, I would like to show you how I would select a location for my bees on my property. And I'm going to walk around the property. I'm actually going to hold my phone, walk around the property and say, okay, look at this area over here. Look at this over here. But I think what's easier is to start out with the map and say, okay, here's an overhead view of my property. Now this area over here, and be able to kind of talk through different areas while I'm screen sharing so that I can show you some of the things that are going through my mind. So I may end up doing a combination of both, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the selection area of how I choose, you know, on my own property where I may and, you know, may not keep bees. If nothing else, I'm at least going to have a recording, but I may go ahead and just video me on the phone with them. And it's not too much excitement with that, but I'm going to reach out to a company and say, hey, listen, I'm trying to get a couple of packages sent in this year. You know, just, you know, you can do it online. You can order online and I can show you the online ordering process, but it'd be cool too, to get on the phone with somebody and just have a brief discussion with them, because there is something specific that I want to talk to you all about. And I'm going to cover it in this next video that I'm recording today. And it'll be a splits. It'll be about splits. It'll be like episode, I think it's like 68, maybe something like that. But then what I'm going to do is I'm going to be putting together as many of these videos as I can. And the idea behind this is to prepare you for your first season as a beekeeper. Because you see, in my mind, when I first set all this up, I thought, I'm not really a podcast listener, so I didn't really know how it all worked out. And I just assumed that somebody hears about a podcast, they go to episode 0 or 1 or whatever, and they just start listening. But that's not the way a lot of people do it. A lot of people hear about a podcast and they just pick up at whatever the most recent one is. So you're a brand new beekeeper and you come in at episode 68 or 69 or whatever it might be, and you're going, whoa, 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 I have no idea what they're talking about. And somebody actually had left a review about that a long time ago. They were like, this isn't a beginner podcast. This guy was talking about all kinds of stuff that, you know, that nobody knows about. And I was like, why would you say that? If you listen from the beginning, you're going to know exactly what everything is about. But like I said, I completely understand that. So that's why what I've been doing is trying to go back and get a different flavor, kind of we're going to have to rediscuss things over and over again. And I guess that's just the only way to do it in the way that, you know, a typical podcast would be consumed. So I'm going to go through the whole process. We're going to start with, okay, determining, you know, what race of bees that we want to have. I've had good luck with Italians. They do well at my house. I'm probably just going to order some Italians. So we'll get the bees on order. We'll have a date targeted. Like, okay, they're going to be here, let's say, whatever, April 10th. And then we'll go through the yard, show you what my selection criteria would be. We're going to go through, I have a whole bunch of bee hardware that needs to be assembled. I have a whole bunch of bee hardware that needs to be cleaned up. I'm embarrassed to even show you guys a video of me down at my property, because there's like stacks of hardware that I need to have a big tub that I can just throw everything into, scrub it all down, clean it up, throw it in a freezer for a couple of days. I mean, it's pretty embarrassing. So I'm not doing any video down there right now, but we're going to do a video of an assembly. While we're on the subject of assembly, if you have a chance to check out the YouTube video, I just put it out yesterday. It's me assembling swarm traps. I just did one in the video, and it's because people have said, like, hey, I just would love to see, you know, what the installation looks like. I said that in the video, too. I said installation like 4 times, but what the assembly looks like. So I put together a really quick video. It's just me in my garage, or actually in my driveway right in front of the house. And I have a crown stapler, and I put my thumb around the back of this piece of OSB, and I was like, man, that's probably not the safest thing. And I'm like, oh, it'll be okay. And I was like, bam, and I stapled the thing right into my thumb. So you're going to get the blood and everything. I bled all over the swarm trap, but we did get it assembled, and that's a video kind of worth checking out if you've never assembled one. The instructions are in that video. They pop up on the screen, but they're also in the description. So if you want to check out how to make a swarm trap, like I said, those plans are there. And if I don't already have one up, I've hung one before in a video. I may not have posted it, so I need to go check that out, which I will do. But we're going to do a video of just assembling hive boxes. And if I can find some frame parts, I will go through the assembly of frames. If I can't, I'm going to try and order some. I really, really like using wax foundation. So if I can find some wax foundation and some wooden frames that are unassembled, I will go through the process of assembling those. If not, I will buy some and we'll go through that, you know. But what I want to do is starting probably, I was going to start earlier. There's just way too much going on. I'm back in this master's program and there's so much. It's just, it's nutty. But my goal was to have started this really like in October. But we're probably going to be looking more towards, you know, middle of December, maybe even as late as the first of the year. But that's okay. We've got plenty of time between like January and March to get all this stuff done. But I'm going to be just making a video, getting it out, So that way, if you're brand new, this is your first season is coming up, or maybe you kind of struggled through last year and you're like, man, and I maybe should have done some things differently. This is like your reset opportunity. So we're going to go through all those things and hopefully enable you to start your season off strong next year. And as you're thinking about that, I want you to start thinking about Varroa mites right now. So start thinking about what you're going to do. If you're a brand new beekeeper and you're like, I don't even know what a Varroa mite is, figure that out. Like, email me, message me, go in the Discord room, be like, what the heck is a Varroa thing? Whatever. You need to know that now. That has to be your number one priority. So that kind of takes care of a lot of those things in the background here. And I told you about the master's program. Phoebe is doing great. She's in college, and I have not fully adapted to her not being at the house. It's kind of like a mental time that I have to go through to kind of decompress. But she's gone, and that's weird, and I'm not still 100% comfortable with that. Elizabeth is finishing up her last year. She is in her final year of her undergrad. She's doing great. Lots of excitement going on for her. And then Leah, we just came back from Wyoming. So I flew into Denver. And the last time we just, you know, we drove out and we split the driving as we needed to. And this time she picked me up at the airport and she literally drove the whole way. I was just the guy who paid for the gas, but which is totally fine. I'm happy to help her out because, you know, she's just kind of starting out in life too. But she had an amazing time in Wyoming. All the work she was doing out there with the forestry folks and, you know, just being outside every day in the fresh air and the wildlife. And it was definitely a life-changing experience for her. So all the girls are doing well. What else do we have going on? That's probably the bulk of it for all of that. I do have a note that I wanted to clear up about ventilation. And this started from a discussion that Randy Oliver and I had a while back. So I've made reference to this a million times. And I never, for some reason, it didn't trigger in my mind, but there is a really important component of this that I want to talk about. And I always talk about the vented inner cover by Honey Run Apiaries, which I really still need to reach out to them because they need to start paying me for as many times as I've sent people to them. But this vented inner cover is basically, if you think about, you know, you stack up your hive bodies and your inner cover typically goes on top and then your outer cover, whether it's telescoping or migratory, would go on top of that. What you can do is you can remove that inner and outer cover, and then on top of that last hive body or feeder or whatever you have there, you're going to go ahead and put this vented inner cover. And then on top of that, you can still put an inner cover and outer cover on top, or you can just go with your outer cover or whatever you want to do. What's really, really nice about this is it's just an empty cavity that the bees can't get to that allows a lot of hot air to come up from the bottom and kind of escape from the top. Now, the idea behind this is, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer, right? It's really, really hot in the summertime. And I use a screened bottom board on the bottom. I have this vented top so air can circulate and move. And I think it just helps things operate more efficiently. Now, you can certainly make the case that, well, bees don't have, you know, vented tops or vented bottoms in a tree. So why do I need one? It's a fair assessment to make. It's an individual decision. The only real benefit that I see to it is it just seems like the bees are a bit more productive because when it's really, really hot out, instead of them being outside and bearding because it's so uncomfortably hot inside the hive, more of them are inside and they're working. But anyway, the point that a lot of people have made, you know, professional people in beekeeping, and Randy kind of brought it up, is this whole thing about, well, you don't need top ventilation. And in my mind, I'm like, what are you talking about? And what I realized is in the wintertime, this top piece that I always talk about, it's not vented in the wintertime. In the winter, that cavity is filled with a block of foam insulation. And what that does, and the manufacturer's website actually tells you this too, and this is something that Randy had brought up, but that piece of foam insulation that sits inside of that cavity will actually absorb a little bit of the moisture that comes up, but it doesn't allow airflow. It's not an open vent in the wintertime. I still strongly believe, as many, you know, bee professionals do, that you only want one entrance to the hive. The bees only want one entrance. That's just, you can look through studies, you can look through anything that's been, you know, peer reviewed and looked at within, you know, the beekeeping industry and apiculture and everything. Bees prefer a single entrance near the bottom of the cavity. It doesn't have to be all the way at the bottom. In fact, most of them in a tree prefer it to be a little bit off of the bottom. And what can happen is the moisture, the condensation that forms in the inside can run down to the bottom and actually give them a little bit of an area that they can drink some water, because bees do still need water in the wintertime, kind of a separate story. But I wanted to clarify that a little bit, because I do not leave that top area vented in the wintertime. I want that warm air to stay in there, but I do want cool air to come in to help mitigate and reduce some of that condensation. So I hope that clarifies that. A couple people have asked me about, you know, a little bit of some clarifying things on that. I do want to take a quick look in the Bee Buzz section of our Discord room, because there was a question just the other day. Baltimore Jose, one of the guys who's in our Discord room, left a message here the other day. Let me see what he said. Okay, his question says, what equipment do sophomore beekeepers need? So second-year beekeepers, like, do you really need queen excluder? So let's just start with that statement on a queen excluder. A queen excluder is kind of another one of those individual beekeeper type of things. Some people are like, you got to have a queen excluder. You just can't live without them. Some people get really bent out of shape because they say that as the workers are moving in and out of the openings of the queen excluder, that it can damage their wings and make it more difficult for them to fly. I really don't have a dog in this fight. What I can tell you is that if I'm using a single brood chamber, this is where I would tell you that you're kind of stuck. You really need to have one, because there's no way for you to isolate that queen in a single brood box if you don't have a queen excluder. So, and again, for those of you who aren't familiar with some of the terminology, a queen excluder will isolate a queen either above or below a certain area, depending on where you place it within your hive kind of infrastructure. So when we say a brood box, I'm talking about typically what would be one deep box, or the tallest of the three bee box options in a Langstroth hive setup. I know there's kind of a lot of buzzwords there, but I'm trying to help explain things a little better. So if you have a single deep at the bottom of your hive, and then you put a queen excluder on top of that, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to keep her in there. She's not going to walk out the front door and then try to find some other entrance into the top, right? She's going to stay where she needs to be. Now, if you have a double deep, now quite often a double deep, or even if you're using, say, three mediums, she doesn't need a huge amount of space for her brood box. So she may go ahead and, in a double deep, she might do, let's say, 7 of the 10 frames in the bottom might be all brood. And then she moves up into the next deep, she might be using 2, 3, maybe 4 of those, but everything else is going to be all nectar, honey, pollen, bee bread, whatever else, you know, resources that the colony has brought in. So a queen excluder becomes less important when you're using a double deep or a three medium configuration. If someone says to me, Jeff, do I got to have it or not? I would say, don't even worry about it. I just don't even worry about it. But the real reason that I like it, again, single brood box configuration, you got to have it. Or if, you know, I really like to keep my brood frames separate from my honey frames. And if you are allowing everything to kind of go everywhere, you kind of get into a little bit of a mix and match kind of thing. See, most of the diseases and illness and things that are associated with honeybees is going to happen in the brood chamber, whether it's foul brood or Nosema or chalk brood, or, well, technically Nosema is more of a gastric thing, but all of these things that, like foul brood and Chalk Brood and Varroa. Like, most of these things are taking place inside the brood chamber. So I don't really like any of that funky, weird stuff getting mixed in with the honey that I or someone else might consume. That's kind of the big driver for me trying to keep those things separate. Outside of that, do what you want to do, right? There's no queen excluders in the wild. But again, in the wild, it's a different setup, right? You have big vertical sections of comb hanging up inside of a tree. So, you know, it's an individual preference kind of thing. But to answer Jose's question, what equipment do sophomore beekeepers need? What you need is to start thinking about the expansion. So I can't remember how many hives Jose has, but I think he's got about 3. If I'm him, I'm assuming that I'm going to have to do a split or do some kind of population control of those 3 hives going into next spring, or they're going to try and swarm on me. So if I'm him, at a minimum right now, just right now, to be prepared for whatever happens, I want to have at least 2 full-size setups to where I can make, let's say for example, he has standardized on a double deep configuration and he's using medium honey supers. If I'm him, I want at least 4 deeps. So that's, you know, 2 deeps per hive in the spare hardware, and then at least 2 mediums per. So he needs 4 boxes per hive that he wants to have on hand. So now he's got his 3 production hives, we'll call them, and then he's got 2 full setups ready to go. That's a minimum. Now, if he says, look, I'm going to do a split on all of these this spring in Korea, I want to have 6 at the end of the year, or he may go to 8 or 10. Whatever your number is for where you want to be, you need to have at least 2 extra. And then you need to plan for the possibility of a percentage. Let's say, for example, that you get to 15 or 20. You may want to have like 20% on hand as spare hardware. If nothing else, I recommend having like 4 or 5 nuke boxes. Just make them. Go buy a piece of OSB or some plywood, or use some scrap stuff you have laying around, and just make a couple of nuke boxes, not to be used as permanent places to house bees, but to use as emergency places. If something comes up and you're like, oh crap, there's all these swarm cells that showed up in this one colony and I've got no hardware ready, you can yank those things out, throw them into a nuke box, let one of the queens emerge, let her get mated. Now you've got a nuke that has a mated queen while you're figuring everything else out, right? That's just kind of one quick example. But as far as, you know, the equipment and the hardware goes, I definitely recommend some redundancy in your total hive counts of available hardware plus nuke boxes. Got to have them. And this is a good opportunity to start looking at other things that maybe you didn't get in year one. So in year one, you maybe were covered head to toe every time you did an inspection. But now you're thinking like, hey, I'm more comfortable, I'm enjoying things a little more. Yeah, maybe I should go ahead and look at getting just a really light top. Or, you know, maybe you just want to buy a standalone veil and you're just going to wear a long sleeve shirt and maybe some nitrile gloves. Now, if you've been using big, thick, heavy gloves, maybe you move to a nitrile glove this year, or at least for part of the season before you try to ultimately go barehanded. And I definitely recommend, if you're getting the nitrile gloves, don't get dark colored gloves. If you have, like, for example, typically what I've seen is the lighter the color of the glove, the smaller the mil count is. Like the light blue ones are a 5 mil. I think it's like a dark blue or a purple are 7 mil. And the black ones are 9 mil. This is based on the Harbor Freight standard, because those are the ones that I buy. So if you're buying those nitrile gloves, then, you know, obviously the black ones are the thickest, and they are the ones that most closely resemble a black bear, you know, clawing through the hive. If you want experience or some information on that, go into our Discord room, which is linked off of the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage, and ask DJ about his experience using black nitrile gloves. He'll tell you all about that. So in addition to, you know, gloves and protection, start thinking about the things that you're going to change about how you engage the hive, things that maybe you need extras of. Like in year one, I remember having a hive tool. And then after losing my single hive tool, you know, 10 times, I then bought like 2 extra. And then I usually buy 2 or 3 every year since then. And I probably have about 20 of them laying. And it's bad. It's bad. Like right now off my back deck, there's one of them sitting out on the counter. It's just like sitting on this countertop on my back deck. I've got three of them randomly inside of my truck. I've got a toolbox in the back of the truck that has about three or four more. I have a shipping container where I store things that is offsite. I think I've got four of them in there, four or five in there. I have a garden shed at my house that has at least three. There was one in my boat. I have a small little Boston Whaler. It's like a 15-foot Boston Whaler. I had one in my boat at one point in time, and I'm thinking, like, what? Why? Like, what did I bring a hive tool to the boat for? The only thing I can think of is, like, I had it in my pocket, and then I went down there for something. I don't know. Every now and then, when it's, like, really hot in the summer, I'll just, like, peel off bee gear and just jump in the river. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say with me. I'm all over the place. But anyway, so, yeah, start thinking about the things that you were maybe running short of, and things that you can use to kind of elevate your game a little bit and make you more comfortable. Just start focusing on your comfort. The more comfortable you are and the more relaxed you are, the more effective you're going to be and the longer you're going to be able to stay out, because this is a big deal. I remember, the first couple of years being covered head to toe, and I was gradually peeling gradually peeling off layers as I was going. But I got to a point where I had, I think, 12 or 15 hives, and I was still wearing full gear. And it would be like, May and June, and I'm just drenched. I would go out and do an hour and a half's worth of work, midday. Because I tried to do my inspections in the middle of the day when there were fewer bees. Most of the bees were out. A lot of bees were out foraging, so I was kind of less disruptive to them. Yeah, that's a whole separate discussion to have. But, I would come in and just be completely drenched, dehydrated. And, if you want to be able to grow your apiary, if you want to say, look, I really want to be a small commercial operation, or I want to start selling honey at farmers markets or whatever you might want to do, at some point, you're going to have to figure out a way for you to be out there in the heat for a really long time. And this is where, I can go off on all kinds of tangents around this one, but, stay away from alcohol. Like if you feel like you got a drink, I really recommend you don't do it the night before an inspection, because you are going to get really, really dehydrated. I haven't drank in 3 years, but I can tell you that I remember days where I would drink, a few beers the night before, go out the next day, and I'm already dehydrated, and then I'm sweating. Like, there were times where I literally was about to pass out during an inspection, where I had to get down on my knees and sit down on the ground for a minute because I was just dehydrated already, plus with the heat and all the gear on. So stay away from the alcohol. If nothing else, make a, all of your inspections, have a big celebration afterwards and drink after you're done if you still feel like you have to drink. But definitely stay away from that. Drink a lot of water the night before. Stay on top of your electrolytes too. So whether it's through a supplement of some sort, or like an electrolyte supplement, or if you want to do like a Gatorade or some other kind of sports drinks. My recommendation with those, though, try to go with the zero calorie ones, or the ones that aren't loaded up with a bunch of sugar. You want the sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium. Like, that's the stuff that you want. You don't want all the sugar and all the crap that goes in there with it. Again, start thinking about the things you can do to make it, better for you to be out longer while you're doing inspections. That's definitely something I would be thinking about. And then also thinking about kind of your marketing strategy. So if you're going into year two and you're like, hey, this is going to be my year, this is the year I want to sell honey, as an example, start thinking about what the processing of that honey looks like, how much of that hardware you want to have. Do you want to use a local bee club and go there? Like, for example, in the south side here of Hampton Roads, I'm a member of the Beekeepers Guild of Southeast Virginia, I think it's called. And by the way, everybody, this is going to be, I think it's 5 years running now that I am up for worst member of the year, because I still don't participate in anything, but a whole separate story. But anyway, they do a thing called Extractaganza. I think it's like, late June, something like that. You bring all your honey frames to them. You work together as a team. You extract your honey. You help with cleanup, and everybody kind of participates. And it's supposed to be kind of like a cool, fun thing. I've never done it, but I know that it's very well received. And it's great because if you don't have the equipment to do extraction, you can kind of leverage all the stuff that they have. So, maybe a local bee club can help you out. But just start thinking ahead of all the things that you want to do. There was this thing we did in the Army a lot years ago. It was called backwards planning. So we would say, okay, here's our end goal. So recognizing that, what do the steps look like going backwards to get to where I am today? And, I thought about it back then. It was all operational stuff. Like, here is this target that has to be, whatever has to be done, around this target. How do we get there? How do we, provide all the whatever to make things happen? that actual kind of technique and approach really, really works well for a lot of things in life. And beekeeping is no different. So think about, okay, I want to be sitting at a farmer's market selling, you know, a bunch of honey every, like in my area, it's every Thursday from like 4 to 7 p.m. They have a farmer's market in the summer. I want to be sitting there at that farmer's market. So how am I going to get all of my product to the farmer's market? And then, okay, I'm bottling it at my house. What am I putting it into? There's some research that's been done over the years. Really kind of cool. There was a video I saw. If I can track it down, I'll link it somewhere. But there was a gal who had done a lot of this research and determined that the packaging of honeybee products has a significant impact on how much you can sell the honey for. So she had some examples where, like, if you had just a generic mason jar, you could sell it for $6. But if you put it into this glass little thing that, you know, glass little jar with a fancy design on it that cost about 38 cents more, buying in bulk, and I'm making up the numbers here, but it was like, you know, 38, 50 cents, whatever it was more, you could sell it for like $2 more just because of the appearance of it. So take the time to do the research into the areas that you're interested in beekeeping. You know, you may say, look, I don't want to do honey. I just want to do queen rearing. I want to sell queens. Okay, cool. So start thinking about how you're going to build out your cell builders. Start thinking about all the queen cages you need. Do you want to make your own candy that goes in the queen cages, or do you want to buy the plugs that are pre-done that you just punch right through? Right? Start thinking about all of that kind of stuff. Let's see what else we have on our notes here. Let's see. We talk about that. I have a note here to talk a little bit about Varroa and where I've made some adjustments in my treatment. And I'm going to go ahead and talk about this right now. And this is what we're going to wrap it up for the day after this, because you guys know me, I can ramble all day long. But I do want to get the recording done for DJ's splits thing. So I want to get that done today as well. But yeah, my strategy on Varroa has kind of evolved, and I wanted to talk to you guys about this. There's a ton of options out there, and there are new things coming on the market here recently as well. And I think it's actually a good time to be a beekeeper, not because it's getting easier, but because Varroa is the number one biggest challenge that we're up against. And there are more options that are coming out that are showing some promise. So what I did for years as a hobbyist beekeeper was just Apivar strips. Now, I've told you guys before that I was kind of crappy about treating them for the first couple of years, and I lost hives, didn't understand why I was losing them. I kind of had that it won't happen to me mindset, and it happened to me over and over again. And actually, I'm going to shift gears real quick, and I'm going to tell a quick story that I told to somebody the other day. I think I mentioned it in the Discord room, but I had some remote hives that I hadn't seen them in a while. I wasn't maintaining them. I was really being a really poor beekeeper. It just logistically, it was kind of challenging, but I didn't treat them. I dropped them off and I didn't provide any treatment. And at the end of that season, I lost one, but two of them survived. And I thought, oh man, you know, I didn't even think about it. I didn't treat these bees, and two of the three overwintered. And I thought, man, I must have the VSH, the Varroa sensitive hygiene. These queens, these colonies must have the VSH kind of trait. So this is really good, because now I can start using these as breeder queens. Now, they were very strong queens already, but I wasn't using them as breeder queens. And I had other things going on. I was completely out of the loop. And I went back, and the next time I saw them again, I noticed they both weren't exactly doing too great. And I did treat something. I followed up and I treated afterwards, but it was really too late. It was kind of behind the eight ball. But in that second spring, I lost, you know, hive number two, and by the end of the summer, like July, August timeframe, I had lost hive number three. It's my 100% my fault, right? You can make all the excuses you want. You're the beekeeper, figure it out, right? So I did a crappy job, and it was at a point too where I knew better. It wasn't like it was my first year, right? First year, you can kind of play the, like, oh, sorry, I didn't think it was going to happen to me. It's going to happen, man. Oh, God, I've heard so many stories. There's so many good people that I've messaged and exchanged emails with, and heard stories around people saying, like, well, my mentor says I shouldn't treat. And I'm like, okay, well, after you're done strangling your mentor, call me back and we'll talk about this. But there's a lot of bad advice out there. There's a lot of people who are like, well, I prefer to be all natural. Hey, all natural is cool, and I love that. But let's not make your colony, your hive that is completely overwhelmed with Varroa, let's not make them the Varroa bomb for your neighborhood and all the bees within your area. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent here, so let me kind of come back. So once I kind of settled in that, okay, I got to make the investment to treat for these mites that everybody's talking about, I was using Apovar strips. So these are strips that you're going to hang, you know, inside the brood chamber. The bees walk across it. It's got the treatment is on, you know, on these strips. And it's pretty effective. I've had good results with it. You do have to kind of be mindful and stay on top of things as far as the directions go. You don't want to have those on while you have honey supers on that are intended for human consumption. So that's an important component of this. You want to make sure that you're, you know, don't use old ones that have been in your garage for 4 years, getting hot and cold and all that kind of stuff. You want to make sure you're using, you know, fresh new stuff. Stay on top of where they are. Like a lot of them have come out with like version 1, version 2, version 3. I don't know what the right word is to describe it, but they are changing the formula periodically to prevent resistance and things. So make sure you're getting the most current formula of whatever one you're choosing. But Apovar was pretty good to me. It just doesn't scale very well. Plus, I like to be able to treat and then be able to do anything else I want to do, whether there's honey supers involved or not. So as things got a little bit larger, I grew a little bit larger in the number of hives I had and hive total colony count. I started using oxalic acid through a vaporizer. I'd used it with a guy years ago with the old school battery clamps. We literally had a cart and a battery, and we clamped on, you know, the positive and negative to the battery, and we'd run around with the thing that had the little disc on it. We'd slam the disc into the front and heat it up. And I mean, it was okay. It was a little awkward, but it was okay. But the oxalic acid, the vaporizer I have, is too expensive, but it works really well. And I've created like a custom, I did a video on it actually. It's a YouTube short, but it's basically just a regular entrance reducer that I have flipped to the blocked side. And I put a, what do you call it? It's like a round piece of metal. I put the whole thing in the video. I can't think of what it's called. It's like a punch kind of thing that you would put into a round. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that I can't describe this to you guys. Anyway, it's a round thing that is about a little bit larger than the diameter of the tube that comes out of the oxalic acid vaporizer. So I've put that piece of metal through the wooden entrance reducer, and now I can insert the vaporizer right through that. So I've got the entire front entrance of the hive blocked by the entrance reducer, and then I've got the vaporizer stuck through that as a sleeve. And now I can actually turn the vaporizer on, get all of the oxalic acid, you know, in the vaporizing process, and then I can just set the vaporizer down while I go and do something else for a minute or two while the treatment's taking place. So I really like oxalic acid. It's a little bit more gentle than some of the things that are out there. There are things that are really, really aggressive. Things that when you have super high mite counts, you know, like your Formic Pro and some of these things, and you have to, it's such a balancing act between like things that are like, everything is kind of air quotes natural. You know, when they talk about things being derived from natural things, but just because they're derived from natural things doesn't always mean they're good. It's like, yeah, I mean, opium comes from poppy plants, but you know, I don't know if I want to be shooting up a bunch of opium, right? I don't think that's, so just because it's natural doesn't necessarily mean it's good. Some of these chemicals and things that go into the treatments are really, really harsh. I've heard so many horror stories of people saying, oh yeah, you know, I did this treatment and then my queen died and I lost half my population of my bees and this happened and that happened. I've never had that happen with using an oxalic acid vaporizer. Now, you may occasionally have to get more aggressive. I may have to treat more frequently than I would if I used some other approaches that are a little more aggressive. I'm fine with that. The real benefit that I have where I live, and it's kind of, I don't want to say it's necessarily unique to me, it's just unique to the forage in my area, is we have a break in the nectar flow. And that break or that dearth, it creates a period of time where the colonies are not rearing any brood. If varroa mites don't have young brood that they can lay their eggs in and reproduce, then they don't get to reproduce. So they will latch on to the bees that are in the hive and just hold out until there's an opportunity for new brood to be reared that they can go and attack. This is prime opportunity to knock varroa down. So what I always do, and I've changed my strategy too. I used it years ago. I was a little too complacent. You know, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to do my end of year treatment. Maybe I'll do a beginning of year treatment, depending on what my mite wash looks like. I'm much more aggressive now. So what I would do now is in the spring, early spring, right as they're starting, I mean, actually really late winter, boom, that's where I'm hitting my first treatment. And even before I'm in my hive doing my first inspection, I'm doing my first treatment on oxalic acid. And then in like your April, late March, early April timeframe, when I get a couple nice days, do that inspection, do that mite count early. And I may hit them again, depending on what the count looks like. But where I really have been hitting them hard is in that mid-June. So mid-June, I will hit about 3 or 4 treatments in a 2-week time frame and knock that stuff down. If I do that, every colony that I have done that with, where I've treated aggressively during the dearth, has not been lost due to Varroa. There's other problems and things that can come up and things that happen, but it hasn't been Varroa related. So I'll dive more into that as we get closer to the season or as we have, you know, the needs to discuss that. But a lot of stuff I covered today, guys. I just wanted to get, because I miss you. I miss talking to everybody. I miss hearing from everybody. And I just wanted to make sure that you guys, you know that I'm still here and I love you. And I just wanted to check in. So I am going to probably take a little bit of a break today. Right now I'm going to take a break. And then I'm going to get this other episode recorded. We'll get these things out to you guys as soon as possible. But it's about all I got. So take care. Be kind to one another. And remember that I love you and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.